You just have to keep going. You have to want it enough to wake up tomorrow and do the same thing over.
It's just me being a hustler.
The only way that I've gotten to this point in my life is to try to treat people the way I want to be treated.
Welcome to Ground Zero Growth with your host, Sam Sapp, owner of Lockbaud.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ground Zero Growth. I'm joined today with my good friend, Josh Peters, owners of Key Consulting KC. How are you doing today, Josh?
Doing great. Glad to be here. How are you doing?
I'm glad to have you on, too. You and I have been friends for a little bit now. Met at a church. Shout out to going to church where you meet awesome people like Josh. It's kind of a fun story there, actually, if you think about it. You and I mean, I think we got a lot closer after a shift in the church, actually. So it's kind of interesting, you know, pros and cons, right? Sometimes when a church gets a little bit smaller, you get a lot closer with the people that are there.
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely been a journey.
Tell me a little bit about Key Consulting KC, Josh. If you can give me kind of like a 5-minute bullet of what it is and what you're doing there. And then we'll kind of start the story over.
So I focus on, or my main thing is IT compliance consulting. I do basically getting companies ready to either go for an audit if they're trying to be audited by for SOC 2 or other kinds of frameworks. Or if they're just trying to maintain some kind of compliance, maybe they don't have a specific regulatory requirement that they have to conform to, but they have some risks. There's always risks in business. I deal with a kind of a cybersecurity overhaul. I look at how they're doing things and advise them on what they need to do better, as well as improve their system, build policies, procedures, make sure that the people are trained properly. I do a lot of different types of training and have quite a bit of there's a storm going on out there. Do a lot of different kinds of training for companies to make sure that their staff understands what compliance is, how to stay up to date on the emerging threats that are out there, and what to do to stay vigilant in this day and age. So that's kind of a real simplified way. I do a lot of other things with that too, but it's all related to IT compliance.
That's cool. So kind of tell me about how. And this is, I suppose, here's where we start to kind of rewind the clock. Because is it safe to say that as a little kid, you wouldn't quite, you know, in high school, it wasn't like you were dreaming, I want to be Mr. Compliance Guy.
Yeah. Compliance has never been on my radar, honestly. Just like a lot of the things in my life, it's kind of changed over the years. And, but yeah, no, early on, I wanted to be in the military. That was my plan. And I started out in high school. I actually joined when I was 17 with my parents' consent. And I was going to be a lifer. That was my whole plan. But yeah, compliance wasn't part of the idea there at all.
So, okay. So you joined the military at 17. What branch?
Army, U.S. Army.
All right. Fantastic. So tell me about that. What kind of drew you into the Army?
So early on, when I was younger, I mean, my grandpa was in the military. His dad was in the military. I had an uncle that was in the Air Force. There was multiple connections that I had in my family to the military. But I always had that sense of, you know, I wanted to serve. I wanted to serve my country. I wanted to serve the people, you know, and help people. That was my big goal. And also, to be honest, in high school, I didn't do too well. I graduated barely with like a 1.6 GPA. I really didn't care about school. It wasn't challenging to me. And because it didn't push me in ways that I probably needed to be pushed. So, I just kind of did whatever, you know, I wanted and didn't really focus on the important things of school. So whenever I got to, 16 years old, I was like, man, I really better do something or figure out, because I'm not going to be able to go to college. And Then the military was there, and I was like, oh yeah, I want to do that, and I can do the military, and I don't need a college degree. And so that was what I started out with. That was my kind of, oh, I can do this, and it doesn't matter if I got bad grades necessarily or whatever. So now you do have to have a GED, or you have to graduate high school, at least graduate. So I did do that. I graduated.
That's cool. Yeah. Have we ever talked about that by chance? I did a little bit of college myself, and it's interesting schooling for me. So I was homeschooled prior to that. So my experience was, anyway, schooling for me, the way I give it to people is the last notable event I really remember kind of instilled it for me. I was doing comp science and I was acing the labs, but bombing the exams. Because I didn't know what acronym I could build the thing, I could set the thing up, I could integrate them, I could even tell you how they function, but I didn't know what the acronym stood for, and so I would bomb the exams. So I literally acing the labs, I barely passed with a C, and that was kind of my wake up call of like, I don't think this is for me.
Yeah, So in school, like college, I went to college later on. I was older when I finally, well, I went multiple times. The first time didn't work out too well. We'll get there as part of the story here soon. But when I finally did end up going to college, I graduated 4.0, summa cum laude, top of the class. They let me be the valedictorian speaker at the, you know, the ceremony, and total different shift from high school to college. I will say I excel at being challenged. Whenever I have the, you know, when I have something that I don't necessarily know how to do it, I figure it out. I thrive on, you know, the unknown and going after and solving the problem. And so when I got into college, it was like, I'm going to do this. And no matter what people have said in the past of, you know, you can or can't do certain things, I was like, nah, I'm going to show everybody. And I actually got my 4-year bachelor's degree in 20 months. So I was, while I was working full time, and we just had a baby, in that time, and we sold a house bought a house in that time. So it was crazy. And it was quite the journey, but yeah, I definitely, that's when I realized how driven I was, and how I wanted to do the rest of my life. That was, from 2021 to 2022, January 21 is when I started, and I graduated August 1st of 22. And I knew after I got done with that I could never go back to the way that I did things before. Just, you know, kind of not that I did things halfway, but I couldn't go back to putting my best effort into every ounce of myself into everything that I'm doing all the time. And so that's just the way it is for me. I'm 110% into whatever it is I commit to. I just do it. And I can't go back. It's really hard when you get to that point. It's like turn off a switch, and I don't have a switch anymore. So it's just all the time go time. So
tell me about your experience in the Army.
Well, so I joined right before September 11th happened. I was in class. I remember, so I went to, I think it was like, I don't know, August 17th or something is when I joined, or somewhere around there. And I remember going back to school because I didn't leave. I was on the delayed entry program. So I joined and then had to wait until the following summer to be able to go into basic training. And so I remember sitting in class watching it on TV, just like, you know, everybody else at that time. And it was like, oh man. And I knew as soon as it happened, I was like, well, I'm going to war. You know, I didn't know where, I didn't know who I was going to be going, where, what country or who I was going to be fighting. But I knew when that happened that I was going to be going to war. And I got phone calls on that day, and it was like, you know, you need to be ready to go at any time. And they were even considering taking me out of school early and sending me to basic training. I ended up getting a speeding ticket and put me on probation. And so I couldn't actually go until that time went past. But it was a perfect time. It was a perfect time for me to go. I went to basic and AIT in 2002. after I graduated high school.
You got probation on a speeding ticket? I'm sorry, I just kind of want to understand that a little bit more.
No, yeah. I was going 76 and a 45, and I popped over the top of the hill, and the guy clocked me right at the top, and I was in a little red two-door Pontiac Grand Am, and that's like attention grab 9,000. So I was caught. There was no going back. And fortunately, I just got probation. I was able to do, I had like 100 hours community service I had to do because it was my first violation. I was very fortunate. I learned my lesson. I don't speed anymore. Don't speed.
I'm guessing that's just the speed you're going, or maybe I'm misunderstanding something with the military, but I'm just used to like, here's a ticket, go on.
No, so the military will not let you, if you are on probation, you can't even join. You can't join. You can't do anything. There's a lot of rules that they have for. So it actually caused problems with my my signing up process and everything. So I was actually supposed to go. I think the way it worked is I was going to join before I actually joined because the timing was off. So I couldn't join until that August. And so that was when the finally got out of my probation and everything. So, yeah, they don't want you to have a record, criminal record when you're especially an active one. It was a misdemeanor. It wasn't anything. It wasn't even a misdemeanor. It was a ticket, a speeding ticket. But I was on probation, so I couldn't go into the military. I couldn't join and do anything while on probation. I had to wait until that was done. So when I finally got done with that, then I was able to join. But it delayed that whole process. So.
Gotcha. Okay. That's interesting to me. Okay. So you stopped that then. I mean, you got off probation and ultimately you joined the military.
Right.
And tell me about that experience. How was basic training? How was...
So basic AIT was back to back. So when you're in it, it's never fun. But as soon as you get out, you're like, wow, that's awesome. You know, you realize what you just did. You have somebody yelling at you to work out all the time. And it's amazing because they keep you in shape. And so you don't have to worry about, am I doing the wrong thing? It's like, they're going to tell you if you're doing the wrong thing right away. So you have instruction, you know, all the time to stay on task, to stay, you know, pursuing the, the goal that you have. And so it was easy. Military, especially basic training, AIT, any of the training type of situations, super easy. You don't have to think. You don't have to process anything. You just do what you're told. If you can follow orders, it's cake. It is the easiest thing ever. Physically, you have challenges because you've got to, you know, run 50 bajillion miles and do 1,000 push-ups a day and whatever, all the stuff that, you know, you would think about. But it is... to get you to the point where you're so physically fit that, you know, you don't have an ounce of fat on you. Now, I was a skinny guy when I joined, so I already didn't have any fat, but I didn't have any muscle either. So I had to build all that stuff up. And the stamina of running and all that, I mean, it takes time and they sure beat it into you. So I excelled. I did very well in my my activity. There's a presidential award. I can't remember what you have to do. It's based on your age. And how fast you run the mile or the 2 mile, how many pushups you can do and how many sit-ups you can do. I could do everything except the pushups to make the 70th percentile. So I was close, but I've never had the upper body strength. And some of those guys, man, their chest was like, you know, they'd go down an inch and they're like 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm like, you're not even going down. You're not even doing a pushup. You have a chest that's bigger than your whole body. So yeah, it's somebody, some people have a benefit over that than others, but I graduated AIT, our basic training AIT, again, top of my class. I really excelled at it. I got promoted while I was in basic training. Before I went into the basic training, I got promoted once, and then I got promoted again right after. AIT went through at North Carolina and Fort Bragg, which was then changed away from Fort Bragg, and then now it's back to Fort Bragg again. That's a weird thing. But anyway, so I really enjoyed my time in all of those places. I loved military life. It was just easy, you know, being told when to wake up, when to go to the bathroom, when to sleep, when to run, when to not run, when to yell, when to not yell, all that stuff. It's just, it's super easy.
What I'm hearing is if you're one of those like top of the class, sort of like you get told a thing and then you do it, but you also like ace it. You're just like, you know, the first time a teacher asks a question, you're like, oh me, I know the answer, like that. If you're that type, then you're going to excel at.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Military. Absolutely.
Okay.
For sure.
All right. That makes sense.
Yeah. It's the biggest thing is, can you follow orders?
Yeah.
If you can follow orders and follow direction, you'll make it. It's really, I mean, they can get you in shape. That's not a problem. They can work anybody into shape. But it's following the orders and following the direction that they give you. After I graduated basic and AIT, I had a very short time after that where I went on a ski trip, actually a ski and snowboard trip to Colorado. Up until 2022, that was the last time I skied and snowboarded. So it was a 20-something year gap in between there, or almost 20 years, I guess. No, it was 2023 is when I went. So a 20-year gap from when I went skiing before. It was a great trip. And then I came home and I started school. That's my first attempt at college. I joined the local community college, Maple Woods, for one day, and then I got the phone call that we were deployed, I didn't know where we were going, but they said we were deployed. So I threw my papers back on the table and said, I can't go to school. And I left and I didn't go to any classes or anything. And, they just basically canceled it all. And then I went to my unit and we started the deployment process. And that was quite the experience. I went through combat lifesaver training, which in the military, as a kind of joke, but not a joke, they call it combat life taker training, because typically you're not trained well enough and usually people end up dying because you don't do things the right way. I never had that problem. I learned how to do it the right way, but it's a joke. Military humor is often weird. So, I
hear it's a little dark sometimes.
It is very dark. You gotta have fun with it though, because there's so much stuff that happens.
It makes sense. It's,
you know, when you go through, especially in a wartime. So after I got deployed, we ended up going to Iraq. So I was in Iraq from March of 2003 until July of 2003. My unit, so I was in civil affairs. We were the people. So they called us the Greenpeace with guns. But often we were doing things like restoring the water supply or making sure they had water, clean water. So turning on the cleaning filtration system, which they had, which was brand new, but they never turned it on. So we turned it on. They had electrical from there. There's a dam in the Tikrit River. And so they had full electric all the time, but they were controlling it. Saddam would control it and limit it to like an hour a day. And so we turned on the electricity and made that full time. We made sure they had food. We made sure the hospitals were opened back up. The schools were in operation. We basically restarted the country after the war, the initial war happened. And while it was technically still a war zone, but we were actively doing those things to make sure that the people were back doing what they were supposed to be doing to keep the country alive and keep going. And the idea is to kind of instill democracy or some form of it. They have a completely different political system over there. It's very tribal run. And so there's a lot of, you know, family this, family that, you know, you'll have they've been killing each other for thousands of years. And this family hates this family and they're living 2 feet from each other. So, I mean, it's a constant. It kind of like actually the closest example would be like the story of Romeo and Juliet, like the two families
that Hatfields and the McCoys.
Okay, well, it's very similar, but it is, you know, you've got this family that just hates this other family, and there may have been a reason 1,000 years ago, you know, that somebody killed a chicken or something and they're just pissed from now on. And so it just continues and gets worse and gets worse and gets worse. And the whole country operates like that. So the North hated the South, the East hated the West, the guys that lived next to each other hated each other. I mean, it was crazy. So it was constant fighting. Trying to fix that is kind of, impossible, because that's all they know. They've only done that for thousands of years. So when you come in go ahead.
No, it's totally unrelated. But have you ever watched Claw? Well, it's not unrelated. Have you ever watched Claws on Netflix? I think is what it's called. It was like an original special.
I don't think so.
Okay, so the short of it is that it's a cartoon. It's good. It's a family friendly, and it's a really good one. Honestly, it's a good, worth watching. But there's this island, and they go. The guy needs to set up a post office, and the interesting thing is exactly what you said. It's two families that absolutely hate each other. But what's fascinating to me is, like, the leadership within the families are almost like semi unified in that hate. Like, it's the order that they know. So to them, it's not chaos. Chaos is getting along with each other. And they even commune more than once. And they're like, look, the things are changing. We don't like this. We're losing control. But I don't think it's even just that we're losing control. It's like, we need to remove this third party so that way we can continue what we know, what we've known. And so at one point, they literally like joined forces just for the sake, just long enough to try to go back to hating each other, which it's a fascinating thing. And so it's fun to look at it in that lens, because on one hand, a cartoon kind of comical. But if you think of a scenario where, and this is something I think we kind of struggle with mentally, because, you know, I haven't grown up in that. I don't think you've grown up in that, probably, right? But the truth of the matter is, you know, if I was born into a family where I saw my aunt die, for example, at the hands of another group of anybody, then naturally I would see myself as being relatively radicalized against that family, right?
Right.
And I might not even know why they killed my family, my loved one. I just know that they did. And so that's, you know, that perpetuates the cycle, and kind of rightfully so, which I don't know. There's a big thing there, but I personally notice this sometimes. I'm sorry to go on a tangent, but I notice this sometimes with the news. I don't know if you've ever noticed this or not, but you'll see a new news outlet come out, right? Or a person or an influencer, and they'll be relatively third party. Like, they just report the things that they see as they see them. But then they say or do something that comes off either right or left leaning, right? It comes off like you're in a particular camp. So they say something, and it's like, whatever they say, it's just them reporting what they know or believe to be true. And all of a sudden it sounds like they're right wing or they're left wing. And then what happens is the opposite side comes at them aggressively, like negative comments, negative feedback. Heaven forbid, but maybe even death threats. And then all of a sudden, that outlet is now legitimately right or left, almost by accident, because they've been radicalized now, right? They have a particular camp. And then what's worse is maybe sponsors come at them like, hey, we want to sponsor you because you said this really cool thing and we really stand behind that, right? And now all of a sudden, just through almost accident and happenstance, they end up in a tribe, so to speak. And the other, sorry, I'm going off on a tangent, but it's just fascinating to me to think about in general. So, all right, the families, there's a lot of infighting, and the theory is, and I think it's a solid theory, if all of a sudden they have a steady stream of filtered water and more regular electricity, it might be easier to start to chain the everyday life, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. Kind of rebuild, because you have to take down what they've been taught, or at least what's been fed to them. as much as you can. Saddam, you know, obviously was doing pretty horrific things if you look at the history of what he did to their country. And Uday and Qusay, his sons, you know, they experimented on people and did all these. I mean, it's horrible, horrible stuff. So the people didn't like him, but they also didn't have a choice. When you're under that kind of regime, you can't just, I mean, you fight against it and they kill you. You know, they kill you. Now you're not just fighting your neighbor, you're also fighting the government and a tyrant, you know, a government that's a tyrant's horrible situation. So it's just a rock and a hard place kind of thing. So when we came in, we you know, obviously Saddam was hiding for the longest time and wasn't in power anymore as soon as we even got there. Because the other thing he did, he didn't feed his troops. So he had people in tanks all the way up, and we saw tanks empty all the way up. They did not fight. They did not shoot. There was no battles at all the way going up to Baghdad, because they didn't have food for weeks. You know, the war time that had already started and was going on, they had been sitting there in their tank without food. So when we pulled up, they're waving white flags saying, arrest me so I can have some food, please. Like, they didn't care about the war effort anymore. It was about their survival. And why would they fight for somebody who doesn't care about them at all? And so it was not really a battle in that to try and, you know, we didn't have to fight in the same way that a normal war is fought. Now, the difference was, once we did get up there and we got kind of stationed in our in the town, I was in Samarra. Once we got stationed in there, we were getting shot at every day after, you know, 7 p.m. It was 7 p.m. to 3 a.m. That was when we were getting shot at. But it was never like a force that was coming at you. It was like one guy or two guys that would be launching a rocket, or they would shoot a mortar, or they would fire some rounds, and there would be just this random kind of activity, conflict, but it was never, it didn't seem cool. I mean, it was coordinated a little bit, but it wasn't like a whole team of people trying to come in and take an area. There was nothing like that. It was just these random attacks. It's kind of guerrilla-like warfare, but it was also, you couldn't even compare it to something like Vietnam, because they didn't fight the same way. There wasn't a
unified,
right, exactly,
front, which is interesting. Okay, so the military, so who are these individuals then, I guess, that are shooting off rockets and shooting at just members of different families that are
anybody who would take $20, honestly. It was, you know, they had, when we arrested the number four guy, I don't know if you remember, I don't know if anybody will remember, but they used to have playing cards, and
I do remember the playing cards.
Okay. I have a sealed deck of those playing cards I will never open. But number four was called Money Man. He was the financier. That's what we called him. He was, so you had Saddam, you had Uday and Qusay, and then the fourth guy, and I can't remember his name, but that guy, we ended up catching him. Our team was one of the ones that were on the hunt to find him. All he did was,
realizing in this moment, you correct me if I'm wrong, but the deck, I'm guessing, is you hand out to citizens in Iraq and Iran the deck, right? And then they're going to be, you know, it's free cards to play whatever. Simultaneously, they're going to have these people's image in their brain. So, and the easy, that's the ace of spades right there. That's him. You're on my card. I get, you know, 100 grand if I call you in. I'm assuming that's the point of the cards, right?
Yeah, it's called psychological operations.
My brother was PSYOPs for the.
So yeah. that is, I didn't know that, but so civil affairs and psychological operations work hand in hand. They're the ones that go around and they have the loudspeaker on the car and they hand out the pamphlets and they, you know, they say, here's all the information for what's going on. And it is propaganda, but it's positive propaganda. We're not, you know, doing what they do where they brainwash the people to, you know, believe that Saddam is the best thing ever, you know, in the world.
You kind of need to change a way of being in general, right? You can either go around with the loudspeakers, we're Big Brother and we're watching you, and your cousin could be Sonarkin them, or you could be, here's water, here's electricity, here's first aid, here's food, you know what I mean? Like that. Right. So, but I'm curious. Okay. So what I'm kind of hearing is this is really fascinating to me because I don't know if I've ever gotten down on this level. So what I'm hearing is, you know, you're coming into a country where the military is for the most part surrendering for the sake of food. Right. But then you have these other citizens, you can't get to everybody. It's a big country. Right. So you have other individuals that for one reason or another haven't received that food, for example, that are getting $20 from those that are losing control. And that's where the rockets are coming from. That's where the gunfire is coming from. Just anybody that didn't receive aid from us, but is receiving aid from the prior regime.
It would, I don't know if it's weird, but the truth is, though, it would be those people, too. Everybody got food. Everybody got water. Everybody got, you know, new power, all that stuff. There was not, you know, we didn't shun people away. You know, they came up and said, I'm hungry or whatever. Everybody got a bag of grain or everybody got, you know, water or whatever. So, excuse me. So there wasn't, it wasn't a lack of. The difference was, the food that we provided or we helped them to get would be, you know, 50 pounds of grain, which, I mean, I don't know if you've ate grain. I don't even know what kind it was. You know, it came in this like sack that, you know, 50 pound sack of grain. I'm assuming it was some kind of like quinoa or something, you know, rice like thing, where you could cook it and it would be filling, but it wasn't necessarily great. They're getting that, they're being fed, they're surviving, which was better than they were already doing. But at the same time, $20, you know, I've heard that saying, $20 is $20, right? So $20 comes in, and $20 over there at that time, especially early on, would feed a family for 6 months. So like good food, good everything. The money didn't, so when we got there, it was horrible. Like their dinar, Iraqi dinar, was like 3,000 to $1, like 3,000 of their dollars to like one US dollar. And, with $20, by the time we left, I don't remember what it went to. It had increased. The US dollar was more valuable, obviously, to them, but because everybody was being paid in US dollars, they didn't quite go as far anymore. So it kind of leveled out to be a little bit, but we based things off of like what we could get for those dollars. So when we first got there, you could take one US dollar bill and get an entire carton of cigarettes. And that was, you know, a one for one translation there. Now, you know, that's obviously not something that is normal currency, I guess, unless you're in prison, which, you know, I don't know how normal people, but yeah, so we rated it off because some of those things you just couldn't get, you know, cigarettes, chewing tobacco, soda, any kind of good, like candy or food that wasn't, you know, deadly, like a good packaged, you know, something. And the reason why we were able to get it and the reason why it started coming in more was because once we started injecting that money into the country, they started going outside. They would go to Saudi Arabia, they'd go to France, they'd go to these other places and buy better stuff, better quality stuff, because they now had Americans that they were feeding and supporting. And we were then pouring that money back into their society. And so, and they had other things. I mean, you could get a lot for a dollar bill early on. It was pretty crazy how the dollars kind of translated. But eventually it got to be where it took $5 to get a carton of cigarettes, which is still, you know, if you're, I don't smoke anymore, but if you look at the value now, I mean, that would be a steal if that was the same price, because there's so much. I mean, it's like $7 for a pack. I still kind of judge things on the economy, how the price of cigarettes are doing. They keep going up and they're just being taxed more and more. But anyway, it's a weird way of looking at things. But it was definitely a, you know, we were pouring into their society in many ways. So not only was the government paying to restore the schools, and we were paying the teachers, you know, we were paying salaries, we were paying hospital people so that they would work, so that the hospital could function, and building up their own infrastructure so that we didn't have to take care of these things as Americans. You know, yes, we had triage centers, and we had, if something, you know, occurred and somebody was really hurt, we would aid them. But the idea was they should go to their own facility and get their own treatment, you know, and have a system in place to be able to do that. The water treatment thing. So they would drink water straight out of the river, and the Tigris and Euphrates River was dirty. I mean, it was really gross. And you can imagine just picking up a scoop of water and drinking it out of there. I mean, you know, you don't know what kind of stuff is in there. And so they had a brand new, in almost every city of the bigger cities that we went to, they had brand new unused water treatment facilities. The only thing they did not have was the salt or whatever. I don't know what they put in them to clean the water out, but whatever they used to do that, they didn't have the material. But they were brand new facilities that were unused, built by Saddam for whatever reason. And when we got there, it was like, oh, all we got to do to get these turned on is provide this stuff. And so we just got the salt or whatever it was from. We had to order it from another country. It came in. We loaded it up. Boom, clean water for everybody. And that was massive. It was a huge change having the clean water. The electricity was, you know, when we first got there, it was an hour a day that they would have power. And then they would shut it off. And so, you know, and then the hour a day didn't happen when it's, you know, 130 degrees outside. So you could hopefully cool off. It's like happening in the middle of the night when nobody else is using it anyway. So by the time when we got there, Americans have certain amenity requirements that we wanted. We wanted the lights on. That was kind of a thing, like, hey, let's have some power. And so we made sure that they turned the power on, and then we controlled the dam and the energy source instead of Saddam and his people. So, yeah, it was very interesting. You know, a lot of the media. So you mentioned the media earlier. That was the first war that they allowed the cameras to go in with the tanks. So I don't know if you remember watching on TV, but the 3rd ID, 3rd Infantry Division went in with the tanks. They had news crews with them on the tanks going in. And that was the first time that had ever been like a live, you know, I don't know how live it was or if it was delayed, but they had cameras on the ground in action. Yeah. And when they did that, they were still pushing a certain agenda. They never showed any of the good stuff that we did. They didn't talk about the clean water. They didn't talk about the food. They didn't talk about us helping the people and rebuilding the schools and doing all that stuff. That wasn't ever included. It was just about the destruction and how many people got killed that day or whatever, because that's unfortunately the kind of stuff that sells. So, you know, the mission that we did kind of felt a little like, man, it didn't even matter. It didn't even, you know, we did all this work and nobody even knew about it. I mean, they knew, the Iraqi people knew, but unfortunately with that, when somebody else would come along with a little bit of money, even those people would be like, well, I'll go shoot at him for a $20 bill, you know, and it was mind blowing. So that part it's a little frustrating. I mean, there's people that'll argue we shouldn't have been there in the first place and all that stuff. But I have a picture of me sitting on one of the rockets that was that they said they couldn't find. With the weapons of mass destruction, I'm sitting on it, like straddling it like a cowboy. I have really? Physical proof. Oh yeah. They were all over the place. The media likes to hide whatever they can. So a lot of people, you know, are still, I've still heard it today.
So you're saying not only were there weapons of mass destruction, but you got a picture with you.
Yeah. They were everywhere. They weren't using them.
And
because
I'm sorry, just to make sure, what defines mass destruction in this context? Because I honestly don't know. I mean, when the soundbite first came out, are we talking I think the theory is nuclear warheads, right?
Not nuclear. It was
ballistics.
But dirty bombs, chemical weapons, anything that can do mass damage in an area. So one of the examples of the experiments that they did, the testing that they did on the northern Iraqis was mustard gas. So they would take mustard gas and pump it into an area and kill like 80,000 people, and just to see if it worked. And so then they had rockets to deliver that system. So the rocket, I don't know exactly what was in it, but there was definitely chemical weapons inside the rockets. And so we found fields of these things, and they had them covered up with sand that was holding down these like tarp things that were kind of camouflaging.
Yeah.
And they had planes. They had an entire air force at the Balad. Can't remember the name of the base that they called it, but in the city of Balad, there was an air base, and they had an entire fleet of like MiGs, fighters, jets. Nobody would fly them because they all gave up. They all quit, but they had the entire infrastructure there to do it, and tanks and all kinds of stuff. So they're, you know, saying that they didn't have this. And I don't know what they were planning on doing with it. I don't know where they were thinking they were going to go. You know, it could have been Iran. It could have been anywhere. I mean, I don't know what their intentions were with it. Fortunately, they never got to use them. Yeah, they were definitely there.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. So one way or another, what I'm hearing is maybe not nuclear warheads, but, you know, they definitely didn't necessarily care too much about the Geneva Convention.
Yeah. Oh, no, that was completely gone. In fact, I can tell you one example. So they would drive around vans with the medical cross, the red cross for the medical symbol, and then shoot rockets out of the back of them on purpose, like rockets, grenades. They would shoot at you from that because we could not shoot them. They knew we couldn't shoot them because we follow the rules. So they also hid inside the schools and would shoot from inside the schools, inside the mosque. They would shoot from inside the mosque. Eventually, all that stuff went out the window when they're actually firing. I mean, obviously, when they're firing and you can tell where it's coming from, then you can return fire. But they would start in those situations. They would also shoot at our helicopters with the Red Cross on them. Anything that they could do to damage that. It's funny that you have rules of war. There are rules of war.
Well, I'm sorry, but there's an intense level of it questioning now. They're coming so naturally. So let's say I'm driving in one of these Red Cross vehicles and you're not allowed to shoot at me. You know, how close am I getting to your vehicle before at some point you're like, no, you can't come any closer? Or did the rules there, is there exceptions? Like what?
Well,
you know what I mean? Because I know that, I'm going to try to get as close as possible, right? In a clear shot.
And they use that. They use kids. So they would surround us with kids. The kids would come out, and anytime we'd go into an area in the city, they would send kids out, and they would be begging for candy. Now, they didn't have to send any. The kids would come out and do that anyway. They'd be asking for candy. They want, you know, water, whatever. And they want stuff. They want you to play with them. They want to kick the soccer ball. They want to do all that kind of stuff. And we would entertain it about this much. Like, you keep them back. You don't. They are not allowed to get close to the vehicle because they would snatch stuff out of your vehicle. But the other thing that they would do is they would hide. They would have the bigger kids come up, and there would be an adult inside those bigger kids. And then they would pull a gun out and they would shoot somebody right there, like as close as they could get to you. They would shoot and then they'd run away. Now, you're not going to open fire into a group of kids. So the chances of you getting that person are very slim, unless you literally mow the entire group down. So they would do things like that. They would use women. They would put babies. They did that in Vietnam too. They would put a woman with a baby and have them come up and try to bomb you. And so they would do anything they could to get close. And so with the vehicle thing, if we could perceive a threat, if they were coming head on at you, you know, and you can tell that they're, you know, intentionally doing something, that's a different story.
They're going full speed straight at you.
That's a target because you can kill somebody with the vehicle. So even if they just ram into you. So the rules changed because of the threat that was happening. But the scenarios that I was giving is they would pull up in a van just, you know, 100 yards away, which would look normal, but it would be a marked ambulance type vehicle.
Yeah.
And then they'd hop out and start shooting at you. So they're able to get into an area because they have this vehicle that we are not bothering. They can get there because, you know, medical aid or whatever. And then all of a sudden they're shooting at you. So yes, we were on guard. We knew that they were doing that. So it was like, okay, something's not right. Anytime you see that kind of stuff, we usually wouldn't stay in an area long enough for them to do that because we would keep moving. You don't want to be in one area any time, length of time anyway. But that's the kind of stuff that they would do to undermine those rules. They knew the rules, but they also knew that they're going to shoot us because we're not going to shoot at them. You know, they know what we can do initially and what they can't do, or what we can't do initially. And the tanks, they would put the tanks inside the schoolyard. So in, like, behind the wall of the school, and then shoot through the wall into the other stuff. So there was a lot of things that they were doing to just defeat whatever rule they can. They're not really playing by the rules. If there was rules, it's war. So there's not a lot of rules at war anyway, but there are technically rules of war for the Geneva Convention. So,
right. Interesting. Yeah. So one, it's yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's fascinating to me because, so I've read a little bit. I actually, frankly, I couldn't finish, but there's a book called Operation Pineapple Express. It's a very interesting book, and it talks about the exit of Afghanistan. And it's fascinating to me because, you know, to your point, you know, you talk about the water and the electricity, but then there were also certain things that just weren't viable for the Iraqi people to adopt anytime soon. For example, a air force that is really good at ground control, right? A military air force, that's not something that you just pop up overnight, like, okay, well, let's order in the salt or whatever you need to get the treatment going and get it up and running. And so, you know, cause for me, you know, when you watch some of those events, it's kind of like how did it so easily get turned over just because we left? And then you read this book and it does a really good job of laying out the Iraqi people that were supportive of us and were part of the military. You know, they went from, because it was so sudden, they went from one day being able to and used to calling in air support in tactical situations that necessitated it and having the rank and authority to do that, to all of a sudden not having access to air support. And that's a radically different environment. Right. So anyway, let's talk about your transition out of the military. I've kept us here a little bit longer than I think I needed to. So
really
let's
to
talk
dive
about,
into the Iraq stuff.
I apologize. Part of it. So now is probably a good time for the audience. And so the fact that my older brother was deployed, I was not, is kind of always been just a little bit fascinating to me because, you know, obviously there's stuff that happened over there that I'll never know of. Never be able to understand fully, and I'm sympathetic to that, I guess, and I think we're going to talk about a little bit of that because your exit from the army is probably not the most traditional one, so to speak, or maybe is.
Yeah, no, I so one thing I always say is I had a blast in Iraq, and physically and literally and figuratively. I was injured in Iraq in 2003, July 14th was the day that I got blown up. And we were coming back from Balad from a mission that we had earlier that day, driving next to a vehicle that was on the side of the road, and they had a big IED in the back of it or in front of it or somewhere around it. All I know is it detonated after, well, first three guys jumped out, shot, blew up this thing. Smoke cloud everywhere, slammed the vehicle back down. You know, we reacted, but everything had already happened. It was done. I got hit in the left foot and the right thigh with shrapnel. My initial, you know, I had pain, but it was kind of that pain that if you jump too high off the jungle gym when you're a kid and your foot stings, that's kind of what it felt like. And so it hurt, and everything kind of hurt because we just got blown up and everybody slammed down on the ground, you know, the truck slammed down on the ground and we're thrown around pretty good. I banged my head. I got a traumatic brain injury from that. And so there was a lot of, stuff that occurred in that you know, few seconds of the explosion. Immediately following, I looked at the first sergeant. He said, "Everybody okay?" I looked back at the gunner in the center. He looks down at my foot, looks back up at me. His face goes white, and he just looks at me like, "Oh my gosh, you're gonna die." And I look down, and of course, I see, you know, blood and everything else, and immediately just turn back at the first sergeant and yell, "I'm hit!" And he bangs on the guy's shoulder and is like, "Get out of here!" And so we had been the bottom of the Humvee. The entire Humvee was just riddled with holes. We had the troop carrier Humvee, so it had the like canvas tarp over the back, and that was just shredded. It looked like stars, like the star holes in there, and then peppered throughout. And then all the tires were blown. I got hit through the tailgate, so through the bed of the or through the tailgate of the truck, a piece of shrapnel went through, basically about the size of a quarter. Or a roll of quarters, and then just went right through my foot, all the way across the arch of my foot, broke all the bones, destroyed, you know, a lot of stuff in there. And then my thigh was just a flesh wound. It went into the muscle. I was more concerned about that because that one did not hurt. I knew about the femoral artery that went through the leg, and I thought maybe that got hit or close to it. So I was worried about that. But really, I should have been worried about the foot. I ended up bleeding for 45 minutes from an artery in my foot. I did not die. Obviously, I'm here. I didn't even need a blood transfusion actually after that. So the fact that I'm here and alive is nothing short of a miracle, for many reasons, not just that one, but that initial one, you know, I should have died right there. After I got back, got back up to Samara, they performed I don't know what they call it, but they ripped all my clothes off, cut it all off, you know, medical scissors and all that stuff, cut everything off. And I was only concerned. I had a CD player in my pocket, and I had this Good Charlotte CD that I had been listening to from my captain, Captain Horton. Shout out to him. He's probably retired now. But anyway, he'd loaned me this CD and several CDs because mine all got stolen before we went over there. And so I had his Good Charlotte CD with me that day, and I was worried that it was going to get broken or it got shrapnel and it was busted and I was never going to be able to give it back to him. And I was devastated about that. Didn't care about the hole in my leg or my foot. None of that mattered. It was, I'm going to get in trouble because I destroyed my captain's CD. Right. But anyway, so they got me.
It's wild. The stuff that we think about in the moment and the stuff that we care about in the moment.
I know for sure.
It doesn't matter at all.
I was pretty upset though too about them cutting all my clothes off, because I was like, I can move, like I'm awake, I can pull my pants off, I can take my jacket off, like I can get undressed for you. You don't have to do all this stuff to me. That was July 14th. I didn't have clothes on me. I did not put clothes on for 21 days. So I was naked from then until 21 days later. I had to fly all the way from Iraq to Germany, ultimately from Germany to St. Andrews in, Fort Andrews in, Washington. And then from, Fort, Andrews to, Fort Sam Houston down in Texas, completely naked. I was on this, the one from Washington to, Texas,
like a gown, a or blanket. Whatever, right?
I had a wool military blanket. No gown, wool military blanket, which is the most uncomfortable thing to touch your skin, period, anyway. But they put me on this airplane. It was a government chartered plane, because they would fly back and forth with like senators and all that stuff. So I'm on this aircraft laying on a stretcher on the plane, facing the rear of the plane, like on my back, looking up at the ceiling. Everybody just staring at me the entire flight from Washington to Texas. And I'm the only one on the plane without clothes, because why would anybody normally be flying without clothes? Anyway, that's
but
my...
But you have the military blanket. I mean, I have a blanket. I'm just trying to understand. Any fun conversations and all that?
No, everybody did. Nobody said anything. I got all kinds of looks and
just a lot of weird stares.
Lots of weird stares.
What's up with the homeless guy in the back on the gurney?
Even in the hospital, you know, they pulled me over into this room as soon as I got to Fort Sam Houston, and they just left me there. And so they did not know if I got hit with depleted uranium. And so they were isolating me, and they put me in a room and they sealed the doors, and everybody that came in had to wear those suits from the movie.
Was there regular IEDs with depleted uranium?
Well, so what they would use is they would use the rounds that would be they would find ammunition, or they would find other kinds of weapons and put it all together. So they didn't have like just depleted. You know, they didn't have uranium that was just sitting there for them to access. It was like stuff that we had shot or we had used. We had rounds from our tanks, our Bradleys, that would have depleted uranium in it. It would do a lot of damage. They would find the extra stuff. They would throw it inside to this big metal can. And then when they detonated it, that would be the shrapnel that came out. So, but if you get hit with the radioactive material, you're going to have more problems than just a regular injury. Although it all hurts either way, it's going to hurt. But, they weren't sure if I had this in me, and if I did, they couldn't expose anybody else to it. So These people, I'm in a room, hospital room, butt naked again, no protection except this blanket. And every single person that's coming in contact with me has one of those full body yellow suits with the big hood and the plastic, you know, everything protected, like PPE to the extremes, like just from the movie E.T. That's what I remember. I was like, I remember watching this when E.T. was found, and, you know, all the government people had all their suits and everything on, and E.T. was scared, and boy was scared, and everybody was scared. I'm like, I'm here, butt naked, with shrapnel in me that could possibly be depleted uranium. And these guys all have suits. And I'm like, what about me? Where's my suit? Where's my protection? Why am I here with nothing? And why won't anybody tell me anything? They wouldn't talk to me. It was so weird. Until they figured out that
nobody said, we're just a little paranoid you might have depleted uranium inside you over 21 days?
They wouldn't talk to me at all. No, that wasn't 21 days. That was the length of time I was naked.
Sure.
So that only lasted a day once I got to Sam Houston. So it was I arrived there on the plane. Of course, they just flew me in a plane with a whole bunch of civilians, you know, people. And I was exposing all of them. Obviously, they didn't care about that. But once I got there, then they're like, oh, yeah, we need to protect our hospital people. So then they
locked
me in a room.
Well, my guess is it's the personnel at the place that has the paranoia and nobody else had. Because
probably.
That doesn't make any sense to me anyway. It's like you've got troops getting hit with shrapnel all the time. And I don't think it's viable to just have every medical. I'm assuming I'm talking maybe out of my butt here. I don't know. You stop me, but it's not viable to have every medical personnel throw on a hazmat suit every time. But for some reason, the folks at Sam Houston are like, oh, man, wait, don't they have uranium rounds? Well, we don't know what, right? Does that sound maybe likely?
Probably.
I think we're guessing, but
when you're in the war zone, they don't have that stuff. So it's life and death. You got to save the guy, right? You got to save whatever, you know, get it out of him, you stop the bleeding, you know, all that. But then once you get back here, then I understand that there's precautions. They're going to do everything they can to be safe. But at the same time, it's like, what about me? If I have this in my body and you guys are just letting it be there and I'm not protected in any way, like give me a mask or something, make me feel, you know, a little bit like you guys. But anyway, and everything, it was fascinating too. All the like the stethoscopes and all the equipment, all the thermometer, everything was plastic. So they could throw it away and it would go straight into the incinerator. So they had a specific isolation room. This entire wing was all for these isolated people. And so that was only, it only lasted a day or roughly a day. But that was the longest day because that entire time, nobody's talking to me. I couldn't talk to anybody else. Oh, I mean, I could talk. I was yelling at people like, talk to me and all that. Nobody cared. And they would just leave.
So
but then
you went in on the 17th. Are you married?
Yeah. So I was young. I was 19 years old whenever I actually went into Iraq. I turned 19 that year and before we went. And
you were how old on the hospital bed in Sam Houston?
19. So that, because it was only like 6 months after I turned 19. So still 19, still, you know, I was young. I was the youngest one in the unit. I was the first one injured. So the team, you know, they were devastated when I left. I felt bad. I was like, I'm leaving my team behind. Like, I was no good. I couldn't do anything. But that thought of like, I'm leaving you, I'm leaving my team in Iraq and I'm going home and they're not, you know, and that was very hard. And there was a lot of other psychological stuff going on with that. I mean, obviously the explosion, the wound, the physical injuries, but the brain is what is really the problem. And that ultimately started my downward spiral from there to the worst times in my life. It took me several years, probably about 11 years, to get out of that spiral downward. And it was just the constant negative process of, you know, anxiety and fear and depression and I'm always on edge and I'm terrified of everybody around me. I'm always thinking of how can I exit this location, and any sound that happens, a boom or a door slam, or, you know, if I smell asphalt, it smells like Iraq. And so I immediately go back. I mean, the flashbacks and stuff, all that stuff is very, very real. And even though, you're like, now, I mean, I'm used to that now. It's been long enough. I've got coping mechanisms. I got ways to function. But for the first long time, I mean, I didn't know what was even going on. They didn't tell me what was happening to me. The military debrief when you get out is like the worst thing ever. They don't have any kind of formal process to like, hey, here's the possibilities of what could happen with your brain. Here's the thought processes that might go through your head. They don't tell you any of that stuff, especially early on, is that there was so many people deploying still. I was one of thousands that came back injured in a very short time span and at the beginning of the war. So they were still actively deploying from all these bases overseas, sending as many bodies as they could. So they didn't have time to manage me or anybody else who was coming back injured. It was just, let's take care of them, stop the instant stuff, and then put them back into circulation as quick as possible. And it wasn't, I have my own thoughts on why they did what they did, but they gave me a bunch of pills. They knew I was in pain. It was nerve pain, so the pills didn't actually do anything.
So there's not a PTSD debrief at this point. Oh, by the way, you've probably seen some things.
Right.
You might want to get that checked out.
Yeah, I didn't know what PTSD was until 2004 when I went to the VA for the first time. And even then,
and how old are you? I'm trying to.
So I was 20. Yeah, so I was 20 in 2004.
Okay.
And
basically without having a clue what PTSD is.
It was actually more than that, because it was it was about a year after I got hurt to when I finally went into the hospital, and I was like, you know, I was on medication. They had given me a anti whatever, I don't know, some kind of pill to help with the anxiety or the psychosis or whatever you want to call it, just to keep me kind of.
So we're a year later, hazmat suits. They've patched up your foot. I mean, we can't see you from the leg down, but for the sake of the audience, you have both of your feet. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I do.
And so they've removed whatever shrapnel theoretically, and you're theoretically good to go. I mean, right? You know, they you've gone through a debrief. Have fun. Good luck in civilian life.
Yeah, pretty much. So I still wasn't out yet. I was in a time they gave me like almost like a year of nothing. So I was still in. I was supposed to go to physical therapy and that kind of stuff, but there wasn't also, again, government. So it wasn't exactly set up for me. I had to figure things out myself.
Okay.
And then try and make it happen. So my physical therapy ended in North Carolina. So I went back to Fort Bragg, till December. I was there from August till December roughly. of 2003, when I came back home, it was like, you're on your own. And I was still in the military, but I didn't have any support at home. My unit was still in Iraq, so I couldn't even talk to them. I didn't have any way to contact anybody else in anywhere stateside. And also the care that I just, or lack of care that I just got from the military, I was kind of like, I don't really want to go back there anyway. I don't want to deal with what they can offer. And so I didn't go to the VA though, until, well, to get in the system, to start getting medication. That's when I started going, because I was running out of what they gave me. So I went in, they kept me on the same medicine, until November that year. December of that year. So I got married. I found my wife and I got married in November of 2004. A month later, I had started working at this job, H&R Block. I was supposed to be an IT guy for H&R Block. And go ahead.
So right around the period, because 04, right around the period when you're going into the VA, finding out what PTSD is, marriage, IT job at H&R Block.
Yeah,
I didn't know about year.
Yeah, I didn't know about PTSD until this incident with H&R Block. So
okay,
so or not with H&R Block, but after. So I had heard things. They had kept me on medication. I knew something was wrong, but they didn't give me a title. They didn't give me a diagnosis. They didn't tell me what it was. So in November, I get married. I think everything's going to be great now. I'm married. Get into December, I get my job at H&R Block. I'm supposed to be an IT guy helping their support their tax people. Not a tax guy. I'm not a tax guy. I didn't want to do taxes. I was an IT guy. So I am talking on the phone. They make everybody go through a week training of the phone system. So you can learn how to do the phones, and you got to answer calls that come in, and you're doing customer service basically for whatever needs that they have coming in. Not technical, just customer service regarding taxes or something. The first phone call I get, this guy named Mohammed starts yelling at me in Arabic, yelling at me about his taxes. He got charged all this money and blah, 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 all this stuff. And I just start feeling all these feelings. I don't know what's going on. I'm having all the emotions come out. I'm angry. I'm flaring up.
And do you know Arabic?
I know the bad words in Arabic. He was saying everything so fast I couldn't really understand, but you can usually tell by the tone in somebody's voice that they're not happy.
No, I'm not saying you have to. I'm not saying you have to know Arabic. I'm just trying to
Oh, but I definitely knew what he was. He was definitely Arabic speaking, and I didn't necessarily understand him. But
and you knew what he was getting at for sure.
Right.
Okay.
He was very, very upset about his taxes. That's what he was. He was yelling at me about. And so he just kept going off, and I in my best customer service way, I said, sir, please, you know, stop yelling. I'm going to have to transfer you. You know, I'll escalate the call. I put him on hold. I walked into my manager's office, who I had known for like a week and a half at this point, and I'm like, sir, I don't know what's going on with me, but I got to get out of here right now. And I just turned around and walked. Now, I carpooled with the guy, and I'm so sorry I left you there that day. If you're listening to this today, I'm assuming he made it home. We never talked after that, but I left. I went to the VA hospital. It wasn't very far.
Never talked after that. So this is why life is wild and such nuance, right? Because it's just like, you know, in his mind, he's probably like, man, this new hire and a jerk and carpool, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, in the grand scope of things, you leaving him behind is probably the lesser of what's happening. Right.
Right. So the things you think about and when you're going through something. So
sure.
I didn't think about that when I was there, but I did think about it afterwards. Anyway, I'm going through these thoughts. I don't know what's happening. I go to the VA. There was this one guy I had met. Can't remember his name at this time, but he said, if you ever have any problems, I don't care if I'm with somebody, you walk in like serious psychological issues going on, you say, I need help, and we'll take care of you. And so I that's all I knew. I went there. I went to him. I walked in. I burst open the door. I said, I don't know what's going on, but I need help now. And the guy that was in there getting counseling or whatever, he's like, no problem, dude. Peace out. And he just got up and walked out. And he's the guy's like, sit down here. Let's talk a minute. And I was like, I don't know what's going on. All these thoughts and everything. And so ultimately come to find out, they hospitalized me in the VA. They took me off the medication I was on. They put me on a new medication to do this because of the medication and the way that it works. They have to basically sedate you. I was pretty hysterical too, so I kind of needed it. But they sedated me, switched the medication. They later told me that the medication I was on, it was Prozac. That medication was known to cause amplified suicidal thoughts, aggravated tendency, you know, violence, all these kind of things. I'm like, why would you put that on somebody? Why would you give that to somebody who's in this state already and then not tell them that this is a potential problem? So anyway, so that's how I found out that this is PTSD and this is what I have now. And that was a month after I got married. So I just brought my wife into this.
I was just gonna say too. So you've married this woman, and your first week on the job, intense ordeal. Next thing you know, you're going to the VA. Like, hey, you said, come here if I need help. I'm here if I need help. Which amazing interaction, right? That the person just like, no problem. Like, you do you. And then they're hospitalizing you and taking, you know, switching out meds. Wow. Okay. All right. Interesting. How long were you hospitalized for? I'm trying to decipher the wife's side now at this point.
It was into the new year. This was like 2 days after Christmas or something like that. It was because we had Christmas break and then I came back to work at H&R Block for the second week of training. So this was like still right at the beginning. It was like a week and a half after I started. But it had to be like the 27th of December as when I started in the hospital. And then I was there for until like the 2nd, or maybe the 3rd of January. So, a week, you know, of time. And during that time, hospitalized, I was on the ninth floor of the VA, which is the psych ward, because I was going through all these crazy episodes with the medicine, which doesn't help you feel any better about yourself when you're placed in that position. But you know, now I'm really concerned about what do I even have? And then thinking, I just got married, you know, we have a daughter. I have these thoughts going in my mind of like, what is my family in for? Like, what did I do to them? And then blaming myself. I had a lot of survivor's guilt that I was dealing with through the war experience. I didn't go into all that detail, but there is a big mental struggle. And I don't care if you spend a second in a foreign country in a war zone. You have PTSD. Everybody has it to some extent. May not be as bad as others, but everybody has it to some extent. And you can't ignore those things. You have to deal with those things. And one of the biggest things for me has been talking about it, getting it out of me, because if it sits up here, it's just going to kill you. And that's most of the people that, you know, they can't deal with it. Nobody can deal with it. It's not possible for us to handle this. You have to get help. And that is a really hard thing in the military, with that mindset of like, no, I'm a strong warrior. I can fight anything. I'll get over this. Like, yes, you will, but you still need help. There, you still got to have the help you need. Sometimes it's medication. Sometimes medication isn't the answer.
Contradictory to the thing that gets you through to begin with, right? The mindset that gets you through the day, which is the I'll take a bullet for you, you take a bullet for me. Oh, I did take a bullet. I'm going to keep firing. Worry about me afterwards. Oh, you know, we're going to have to take the bullet out now and we have to do that to move on to, you know what I mean? That handle it in the moment. Don't worry about the consequences. Solve the problem. I've got you, you've got me mindset. I think that you need, isn't it safe to say that's the opposite mindset that will get you through. You know, it's okay that I'm here on my couch in the States and my brothers in arms are still overseas.
Yeah, it's so it's different because you're in survival mode. When you're in a war zone, it's life or death. It's either us or it's them. You know, who's going to make it? And you don't have time to think about the stuff that's happened to you or that's happening to you currently or what's happened to the people you know. You don't process any of that because you don't have time. If you think about it for a second, you could get killed. So you just have to act. You have to react. You have to move. You have to keep on with the mission. You know, the saying in show business is like the show must go on. Well, in war, you're still at war, whether you want to be or not, whether your friend gets shot, whether you get blown up, like you're still in a war zone. So if you start going away from that mindset.
You gave a really good example when the IED happened, when the explosion happened. When you said we were reacting, but it was already over. Everything had already happened. I don't know if I could think of a better way of explaining a scenario in where in mere seconds, everything changes.
Right.
And so, yeah, that type of, you know, it's martial arts is a good example. If you're thinking through your next move, you're likely to lose because the person on the other end already knows exactly how to respond in this moment,
right?
Given the circumstances. So, yeah. I'm sorry. We're obviously going to go over a little bit here, which is fine with me if it's fine with you.
That's fine.
So tell me about. Okay. Tell me about your recovery out of that.
So initially it was very hard. It's still hard. I always say getting blown up is easy. Like literally anybody can do that. That's the easiest thing in the world. You just be in the wrong place at the wrong time and you can get blown up. It's the survival afterward and not even the physical part. Your bodies are pretty resilient, you know, and we got good surgeons. We got good doctors. Like there's good medicine to keep people alive. It's the after the fact. There are problems. Yes, I have some physical stuff that I still deal with, some pain, some, you know, it's not as bad anymore. I've had multiple surgeries to fix that. But the mental part never goes away. It's not like, oh, I'm healed all of a sudden, you know, or you can give me stitches in my brain and all of a sudden I'm okay. Like, you probably do a lobotomy, I guess, but that would be a totally different kind of situation. It's not really solving a problem, just creating a new one. But the idea is when you're going through this stuff, again, like when you're in the war, you're not thinking about it. So all this stuff is just piling up in your brain. Brains are very powerful. And, you know, we know technology, it's like a hard drive, but a huge one. And you keep everything that's ever happened to you, everything that's happening to you currently, everything that you are going through in life, the pain, the good stuff, the bad stuff, all of it, it's all in there. Now, the brain does a good job of filtering out what you need to keep and what you don't need to keep, but you still have these memories that are locked away in your head. When you're going through the trauma and you're living it, you don't have time to process anything. You're not processing anything. And all that stuff's just getting stored up and waiting for it to one day burst out. When the trigger happens on that PTSD moment, it's not just the war that's affecting me. It's my entire life, everything up to that point that's affecting me and anybody who's gone through this. So the blast that happened was the trigger, was the ultimate, here's the thing. And the way that I describe it is every time anything happens in your life, you stub your toe, you slam your finger in the door, you burn your hand on the stove, anything you learn in childhood of like, don't do that again. That hurts. I cut myself if I drop the glass and pick up the glass. Like those things are in your brain and you learn, I'm not going to do that again. I'm not going to lay my hand on the stove. I'm not going to touch fire. I'm not going to do these things, right? Because your brain learns and knows not to do that because it causes harm. So, but those are defense mechanisms that your body, your brain puts in place so that you don't do those things. When you get to that one thing, that one situation, it could be a car wreck, it could be an explosion, it could be any number of traumatic events. When that happens, all of those defenses you put up your entire life in your brain now go to block that one thing that's coming at you. I mean, in my case, this explosion, it's all coming out and going, we got to stop this thing because it hurts. It's loud. We don't want it. We don't want it to have the memory. We don't want to deal with that. And it just goes up there and tries to block it. Now, all of that defense that you had all these years blocking all this other stuff and preventing it from all happening at the same time just goes. And so you have like million bouncy balls in your head of every traumatic event that's ever happened in your life all at the same time. And not only can you not defend what's just currently happened, this blast that took place, but now I can't put all those things back in their boxes. I can't put the defense back up and have it all tucked away. Everything's just going crazy. And the other thing that they talk about it like a light switch. So you go through the trauma and everything's okay until it's not. And then when that light switch flips, it just breaks. And now it's always on. You always have adrenaline. You always have the heart rate pumping. You always have these thoughts of the fight or flight mode. You're always there because that's what's been triggered in your brain. And so it can't turn that off. So when you're trying to process this data, you can't. You're not able to process it anymore. And the only way that you know how to defend it is by covering it up with alcohol or drugs or movies or games or anything to escape the reality of what you're physically going through, psychologically going through. Pain is one thing. Mental problems, totally different battlefield. You can have the best day in the world and one thought comes up and it ruins you. And this can happen to anybody. Ruins your whole day. One thing happens and ruins your whole day. Ruins your whole week, month, year. That stuff, that problem and that process that you're going through lasted for me for 10 years. So that is a constant, always getting worse process. Nothing ever improved. And it just keeps feeding on each other. And that's why I mentioned that spiral of going downhill.
Do you think so? You know, I'll be honest, I've known a few people in the military and a few people deployed, and I don't know if maybe it's just the context that you and I are talking or, but you're a lot more open about some of the experiences that you've had. And the kind of two things is, for one, is that an indicator that you are, you're more past it than you were before? And the second question is, Do you think, like, is the ability to talk freely about those events healthier than not talking freely about them? So just to come Absolutely. Right out and say it, is the fact that I'm asking these questions at all, is that difficult to you? Is it something that for when we've got other people in our lives that have, and this is, there's so many things that are like partial to me, but this and PTSD is one of them because it's something I've had some degree of outward looking in experience on. Is should those of us that have loved ones that have been deployed that do have or have had PTSD, like, is it wrong to ask them about the events that they had? Is that triggering something in their mind when you do that? Is that bringing back up difficulty?
So there's a lot of questions in there. I'll try to remember.
Sorry, it was a lot. And okay. Obviously you can't speak for everybody that has. Yeah. I'm just, so you know, you talk openly about it. So that.
Yeah,
that.
I'm open about it because that's what's helped me. That is the only reason I am here today. Like, well, one of the reasons I am here today. My faith is the number one. God is the reason I'm here. He is the only reason I'm alive to this day. Me being open about this and talking about it gets it out of my head. And I mentioned that before, but that is the biggest problem and a lot of problems with military. And I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings about this, but there is the saying, you've heard it before, like, it's all in your head, right? That's the saying you've heard, especially when somebody, I'm messed up about this. It's all in your head. You know, usually they say it as a passive thing. I'm not meaning it passive. What I mean is it is in your head. It is a true in my head. What's going on is in my head. Nobody else can see it. Nobody else can visualize what I've experienced. They don't know. That makes it very hard for you as somebody who hasn't gone through that to be able to go to them and say, well, why don't you tell me about this situation? because there's a couple things that happen there. They may not trust to open up to that because they don't know what you're going to do with it. A lot of people, especially veterans, especially wounded veterans that have gone through this system, have been exploited by organizations. I'm not going to mention any of them, but they are exploiting veterans for their own benefit, not to benefit the veterans. They make a lot of money in donations, and they continue to put people on the front page of an advertisement and use their images and use their stories, but they're not actually helping them. And what veterans that have been through that now are like, well, I don't want to talk to anybody because all they're going to do is throw it back in my face, or they're going to use it against me, or they're going to benefit off of it, and I'm not going to get any help that I actually need. And so there's a lot of stigma around it. A lot of veterans don't talk about it because the military flat out says, if you say the word PTSD or say the letters PTSD, your career's over. You're done. You're never going to serve in the military again. It's over. Now, they won't tell you that, and it's not on paper anywhere, but that's the truth, and that's the way it is. So that is the way people think. I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to deal with it. I'm going to push through it. I'm going to get past it. And then they snap. They kill themselves. They kill other people. Something bad happens. And then the media throws it back and say they were a soldier. They were a Purple Heart recipient. They got wounded, whatever, all these things, and put this target and say they were a veteran. And then what that does is that furthers that stigma of, well, all veterans are bad. That's not the case at all. We have issues, but everybody's got issues. Who doesn't have a problem in this world? Everybody's got problems. The difference is we have been trained and taught in a way that you can't express yourself. You can't open up and talk about it because you're going to be punished in some way. You're going to lose your career. You're going to lose your ability to have a future. And that sets people down in down a bad path. Me, I already lost my career. I couldn't stay in. That's not true. They gave me the option. I could have pushed papers for the rest of my term. I did not want to do that. I wanted to be civil affairs. I wanted to be in the fight. I wanted to be on the ground helping people. That's what I wanted to be in there for. Physically, I could not do what I wanted to be. Which that's a whole nother discussion, but that identity crisis that I had because my entire identity was locked up in that military, I lost everything. When I could no longer be in the military, I didn't know who I was anymore. And so it took me 11 years to even get to the point where I was okay with myself. I still had to figure out who I was. And that journey takes people a lifetime by itself. So when you already are there and then you lose it and have to start over, it's another situation. So you got other problems dealing with that. But a lot of people, anybody who's been in trauma, not just veterans, but anybody who's been in trauma, don't want to talk about it because it brings up things you don't want to deal with. We don't want to relive the bad stuff that's happened. Nobody wants to relive that because it's traumatic. That's in the name. It's a trauma-inducing thing. So talking about it usually brings up things you don't want to talk about. When you're in a therapy session, when you're talking to a therapist, they're bringing these things out because you need to talk about them. You don't want to talk about, but you need to talk about. You need to get it out. You need to process through it. Yes, it happened to me. Yes, it sucks. It's a bad situation. I got to the point at that it was beyond the 11-year mark, but that was the mark. I finally hit the rock bottom, and I had to make a choice. I was either going to end up in the ground, or I was going to get better. And I usually say I was either going to get bitter or I was going to stay bitter or get better. And that is a choice that everybody has to make. Everybody in life has a choice. We have lots of choices all the time. But because it is in my mind, I am the only one that has control over what I get to do from now on. If I stay stuck a victim to my mind and do what my mind says, I will never get out of that. I will constantly be stuck in that circle of destruction, and you cannot stay there. So the only way out is to tell yourself, I am not going to stay here. I'm not going to be the victim anymore. And I'm going to move past this. It's a choice that you have to make for yourself. Nobody else can make that choice for you. So as much as I want to help people in this world, I still can't help everybody because not everybody's ready to make that choice yet. And I was there for a long time. I'm so glad I made that decision because once I did, then things started getting better. And it wasn't done, and it's not done, and I'm not arrived. I haven't figured it all out yet, but I am better today than I was yesterday and the day before and years ago. I am so much of a different person now. And the difference now is because I made that choice back then that I was not going to be that guy anymore. And it's, you know, victim mentality, whatever label you want to put on it. I could not do it that way anymore and make it in this world. And I don't believe anybody can. If you have that identity and you're stuck in that process in your mind of I'm wounded, I'm a has been, I never will be this. If you say that, you're right. That saying of you either can or you can't, and whatever, if you say you can or you say you can't, you're right. That statement is very true. And I believe that with all of me because I've lived it. I have been at the worst possible place that a person can be. And I've climbed out of the hole, and not by myself. God was the one that helped me through it. My family, my church, my friends, those are the ones that helped me get through it. But if I never made that choice, none of those people could have helped me, because it's on you. It's on you as the person to make the decision to change who you are. And that is where, you know, the mind is very powerful. We have all authority in this earth. We have authority over our mind, but you have to claim the authority that you've been given and stand and walk in it, and then go forward and not go backwards. And that is the part that is different between me and other people. And I'm not bragging on myself. I've just been through a lot of stuff, and I know that's the answer. And I've seen a lot of people that have been so close and then missed it and aren't here today because they made a choice that's forever because they couldn't see past it. And I've been so close to that. It is so, so, so easy to think those thoughts. And it is so easy to believe that one bullet would solve every problem. And that thought process is... it's not an easy one to get to. It's not an easy one to get out of. But when you're there, it's really hard to see the light. And you got to have people in your life that can say, that's not who you are. You don't need to do that. I care about you. And you have a purpose on this earth. I know what my purpose is now. I had a long time where I didn't know who I was. And it took me a long time, and I never would have got here if I didn't make that first choice. And it's not easy. It's not an easy choice to make. But that is the difference between me and other people. And I will say, if somebody's listening and you're dealing with stuff, I understand. I would love to talk to you about it. I would love to help you, but you got to be ready to make that decision. And until you're ready to make that decision, you're not going to get fixed. You're not going to get better. It's just going to stay the same way because you're the one that makes the difference. So that's my encouragement to anybody out there, is you can be better. There is hope. There is so much opportunity to fix the broken, but you have to want it and you have to go towards it and not stay in the brokenness that you're in. You have to make that choice. So that's the difference between me.
So how do we get to try to get to a point to wrap up? How do we get from that to Key Consulting, KC?
So I'll try to sum it up really quick, because I know we've talked a long time. I've talked a long time.
We got to a lot of what we needed to, which is huge. But
yeah,
I want to make sure we get you to where you're at currently.
For sure. So my journey, the real journey, obviously started, you know, a long time ago, when I got hurt. But the process to get to here has come rather quickly, actually. In 2020, my life changed for the better. I had mentioned we have a daughter; she's 22 now. My son came along. We found out we were pregnant with our son in 2020. And that was all this stuff that I'm about to say happened at the exact same time. So I got a full-time job with T-Mobile. At the same time, I got my full ride scholarship to Colorado Technical University. I found out that I was pregnant, or not me, my wife was pregnant with our son, which we had been trying for 15 years. And all of those things happened in the same week when we were in Puerto Rico on a vacation that was paid for a business that I was working for on the side. So there was all of these great things that happened in the one of the worst years of people's lives, right? 2020 was a very bad year for a lot of people. And it was that moment was like the start of the difference in the path that I'm on now. The college thing, I had tried to go to college. I went for a year and a half. No, 6 months. I went for a semester before I got accepted to K-State. And I won't go into all the details, but I ended up not making it at K-State. It was a bad time in my life. This was in that 11-year time before I hit rock bottom. I thought I could do it, but mentally I was not capable of handling anything, really, and let alone trying to do a college degree. So I ended up coming back home, and I kind of put college on hold. But I had to work. So I just got a job I was working at a Golden Corral or something. It was a dishwasher. I just had to work, and I'd been unemployed for a period of time. And so that might've happened before anyway, timeline, it doesn't matter. I had got a job that led me to where I am today. I became project manager. I worked project management for construction projects for telecom. So it was a dark fiber project in Kansas City specifically. It was an upgrade for Verizon when they were switching from 4G to 4G LTE. So they needed more bandwidth. And so I was responsible for, at the time starting out, responsible for fiber lines, planning, permitting with the railroad, all the different stuff with that. That transitioned into another project management job where I was managing installation at Google Fiber for all houses that were getting signed up. That transitioned into a construction photography company, MultiVista. I was an operations manager there for almost 3 years. That taught me how to run a business. I basically ran everything and to keep the functionality of the team going. And I had direction, obviously, from my boss, but I had to make sure that we were maintaining that activity and running the show on a daily basis. And then that led me to T-Mobile, which I became a senior analyst in compliance. And that's where I kind of found that niche of like, man, everybody needs this. I want to do this. And I was told by a person at that time, he's like, once you know this skill, you can do anything with it because the market is so, it needs it. We need people in this job, but there's not, I mean, the big four companies out there, the big kind of accounting firms were looking for analysts and they couldn't find anybody. They were hiring people straight out of college with no experience and paying them a ton of money. And I was like, oh my gosh, there's opportunity here beyond, even just working for another company. And so I ended up going to school while I was at T-Mobile. I got that full ride scholarship, did amazing things there. But I already knew all the stuff. I was literally doing the job that what that education was before. I did it in my degree was in business administration, but also in information technology and data analytics, which was what I did on a regular basis. So I knew everything pretty much already in my experience up to that point. So college was super easy at that point. I suggest go later in life if you're going to do it, because that's what worked for me. But by getting through that, I got done and it was like, well, now what? I graduated. I didn't get a raise. I didn't get a promotion. I didn't get anything different than what I was already doing it. And I realized the only opportunity for me was going to be to go to another company or, become higher ranking in the company I was at. But eventually I wouldn't be where I wanted to be without basically owning my own business. And so I had started some projects on the side. My Key Consulting has been around for over 7 years. I had been doing business periodically, doing different things, but never really could put my all into it because I still had a full-time job. And I needed money, and getting clients takes time. Any business owner knows that. And so I couldn't put the all in into it. And then fast forward to February of this year, I was let go. I was laid off from my job at T-Mobile. And I knew that day that this was it. I'm done working for somebody else. I'm going to do this on my own. And I went all in with my business, businesses. I have multiple. I went all in with Key Consulting, and I started reaching out and making connections and talking to people. And one thing led to another. And I was introduced to my current client. client from a friend of ours that we both know, and she had led me to where I am, and that has been a door opener for me, and that right there was like, oh my gosh, I can actually do this. I've shown myself through this experience, like I already know this stuff. I know it to like very well, and I can help other people do what they can't do. And so I'm basically taking the enterprise level compliance that I've learned over the last almost 5 years and incorporating it into small businesses and medium sized businesses that would never have the opportunity to pay the millions of dollars for these mega corporations to come in and fix all of their stuff. And so I'm able to do it at a fraction of the cost, and help the business get out of, you know, or get into a better situation and get out of where they were before. And so that's kind of the evolution to get me to here. I know we talked about a lot of stuff, but that journey that I've been on over the years, through the PTSD, through the physical injuries, through the struggles and the layoffs, I've been laid off multiple times. All of those things have made me who I am today. And because of those struggles and because of those trials, I'm able to do what I do and be able to function in a capacity that I never thought would have been possible. And that's kind of that go 110% in everything I do kind of thing. I can't go back. I can't turn it off. It's just who I am. So that's how I got to where I am now. Hopefully I summed that up enough there in a short way. But
no, that's good. Yeah. That's great. And it's something I thought of too while you were talking. It's a little bit unrelated to what you're saying, but just something that came up. It's fascinating to me how in business in general, and especially small business, how trust works. And it's almost like a currency. It can literally be transferable.
Better than cigarettes.
Right. Hey, there we go. Nice callback. Where, you know, you can be introduced to somebody else through the right person. And, you know, depending on the context and angle, it can really be one of those scenarios where it's like, okay, I don't know you intimately, but I know that other person. I know that other person trusts you. And so thus I know. And it's absolutely fascinating to me. And it's something that, frankly, for me, I've had to kind of learn and grow into because, you know, from the partnership, the past, it's made it a little bit difficult to, you know, I think for the most part, people know me to be trusting, which is true. And I am, specifically when it comes to like information about myself. I'm pretty open about myself. But when it comes to like, you know, I'm going to introduce you to this person so you can work with them or, you know, work on this thing. It's something I've had to kind of get over. And I think that's something a lot of people have to get over because I know a lot of small business, you almost kind of want to see the work before you trust the person to do the work.
Right.
And yet it's interesting because that, you know, especially in our business, our line of work, that's not how it works at all. So you almost have to have a system of transferable trust for it to work at all. Anyway, so as we start to wrap up, there's two questions. Now I'm remembering the flow, man. There's been such a gap between the podcast. I was like, how does this flow go again? So there's two questions that we like to ask on a somewhat recurrent basis. So we have a motto over here, and the motto goes, if we have seen further, it's by standing on the shoulders of giants. Who's been a giant in your life that you would like to pay homage to in this moment?
There are a lot. I'm going to say my wife, number one, has been through the absolute worst in my life and probably the best in my life, too. And she's been through all of it and has never ceased amazing me and what she can put up with, first of all. But she is very, very, very inspirational to me to keep going and to keep pushing. She has driven me even when I doubt myself, when I doubt my, you know, my abilities, or if I think I can or can't do something or whatever. She always gives me the truth. She brings me back to the reality of things and really just anchors me down. And that is such a blessing to me. There are so many other people, that I could think of. My dad's been influential to me. He's always been very hardworking, always given his all, you know, in anything he does. And so I definitely have my work ethic, I think, because of his work ethic. And just having people in my life that, are encouraging to me. My pastor, Pastor Randy, has been a very influential person in my life, to keep me on the right track and help me get out of those times when, you know, I'm in my head and just really dealing with stuff.
Shout out to Lift KC Church on that one.
Yeah, for sure.
Keep going.
I could probably ramble on. Lindsay Howerton has been a huge impact in my life. She was on your podcast. I don't remember what episode, but early on, and I listened. And as soon as I heard it, I was like, I got to meet her. And then you ended up introducing us. And that's ultimately who helped me get my first big client there. So shout out to Lindsay. She is absolutely amazing. And she has this gift. You got to meet her. If you haven't, you got to meet her. She's got a gift to be able to call out the good in you in a way that I've never heard anybody do. So she's been impactful as well. And Sam, you've been impactful in my life. You've been that guy in my corner that's been cheering me on. And you do this great thing where you actually play both sides very well, of like the good and the bad, you know, like the little angel and devil. You're like, yeah, let's go, let's jump. And then right after we jump, you're like, should we have got a parachute? Should we have a plan? You know, should we, like, and I'm like, how, why would you help me jump and then not have this? Like, so yeah, you've been there with me through some of those as well. And, nobody else has ever done that with me, quite like you do. So I appreciate that big time. You've helped me really focus on things and pay attention to kind of where I should be pointed. And that's been very, impactful. And you're definitely a giant in my life as well. So
thank you. There's a saying, I thought of it when you were talking about your wife. And the first time I remember hearing it, Isaac Mumbai, a fantastic speaker, his mother would say, keep your eyes on the sky and your feet on the ground in order to keep going at an accelerated rate. And so what has been, this is kind of an interesting one, and I wish I had a way to zero it down, but what's been kind of like a rule of thumb in your life that you've found to be true again and again and again? Something that since forth has maybe carried you through those difficult times where you just, that saying comes back up, or just something you're like, you know that to be true. You're like, you see the thing and you're like, there it is again.
Yeah. So for me, The number one thing that popped into my head when you said that was, I will never quit. That statement right there, I think could probably, you know, epitomize this whole journey. There's so many opportunities to quit in life, about anything. And while you're on the journey, especially when you're going through stuff, it seemed very nice to be able to quit, you know, and nobody's keeping you from it. I mean, anybody can make that choice. And not just, you know, the ultimate quit, but like just stopping working or, you know, give up on a dream or whatever. Like though the world has gotten very easy, to give up. It's become the thing, you know, and can't, that word can't is very huge in people. I can't do that. You know, or something like that. And I mentioned skiing at the beginning, and I didn't do it for 20 years. When I finally did do it, I actually snowboarded down the mountain with the guy that only had one arm. So he had lost both his legs and one of his arms, in an IED blast in Iraq or Afghanistan. I can't remember which one. And he was going down the mountain with me on his own snowboard, with two prosthetic legs and a prosthetic arm. And I took can't out of my vocabulary that day. And it was absolutely amazing to see that that was even possible. I had no idea. I'm sure somebody told him, you'll never ski, you'll never snowboard, you'll never be on a mountain again. And he didn't let that stop him. So I took that and I was like, you know what? I'm not letting anything stop me. I'm taking that can't word out. I can do anything. It's going to be hard. It most definitely is going to be hard, but I can do it and I'm going to do it and I'm not going to quit doing it, until I get there. And so that is the ultimate, you know, that I'm not going to quit. I will never quit statement. That is the core of my life. Everything I do, I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to quit until I'm told it's time to move on. I'm going to keep on going. And, which, you know, can be a bad thing too, because, you know, I would have never, would have never left T-Mobile, but I probably wouldn't have made the decision to go into business right away. If I would have quit, I would have gone, you know, tried to work for somebody else or something. So, having that choice made for me, made it a lot easier, to make that jump. And, when you don't have any, other option, I think you've said to me before, you know, burn the boat, you know, and because if there's no going back, you know, you can only go forward. If you can't go back, it's only going forward. And so no matter what, it's like, I'm not going back that way. This is the direction I'm facing now.
Bill Green. Another episode reference. Burn the boat.
It's a good one. I mean, and a lot of these though, like I think I've learned some of these saying, that's why I connect so well with your show, is because, you know, the stuff that you bring out in people and the way that you do this, it connects. I connect with them. They connect with a lot of people because people who are driven the same way have a very similar path. All our stories are different. We all have a different journey to get to where we're going, but everybody's got to make those choices along the way. And if you have can't in your vocabulary, or if you're like, I'm not going to make it, I'm just going to give up. You're right. You won't make it because you're just going to give up. And so you have to keep on going and keep pushing. And it's almost you don't have a choice. You know, there is no other option for me now. I don't have any other option. I just officially signed my severance letter, yesterday. And it was, you know, now it's officially official. And I even had that moment of, you know, the heart racing and the heat, you know, going through my whole body. I'm like, oh no, it happened again, you know, and even though it's already happened, it's like, it's still that, you know, there's still emotion. It's not that I'm not going to have feeling ever again. But the difference is like, I was done with that as soon as it happened. It was like, oh, cool. We're already there. Let's go and just keep on moving and keep moving forward. And so, you know, with any of these things, you know, that I've talked about or other people have talked about, it's like the difference between the people that do it and the people that don't is the ones that do it didn't quit. I've read all these self-help books and all these different, you know, how to do this and guru this and all that stuff. And every one of them has a similar, very, very similar journey. I mean, maybe a different path to get there, but the same storyline where it's like, this happened, then this happened, and then they did this, and then they made this choice and they weren't going to go back. And now they're, look where they are. They're a bajillionaire or whatever. And it's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I'm on that journey. I'm doing it right now. You're doing it right now. Everybody that's been on your show is doing it right now. And everybody who's going to be on here is doing it. And it's just the journey is the that's part of it. You know, we have these people in our life that have helped us get here, and I'm not going to give up, and I'm going to keep going. And because of all these things and the relationships and the network and the groups of, you know, like-minded individuals that are helping to keep me motivated, it's like, I'm never going to lose. Like, I can only win. I'm not going to quit. I'm going to keep on going. And all the other things I just said. So those are my ending notes there.
Thank you so much, Josh. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciated having you.
So. It's been great. I appreciate you having me. Thanks.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Hello, everybody. I wanted to thank you for listening to today's episode. It's such a blessing to be able to interview some such fantastic individuals. If you're interested in listening to more, we look to post every Thursday at 10 a.m. You can find us on YouTube, Amazon Music, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much. Have a blessed day.